of warning. I am in a sinister mood. I just thought you ought to know. I'd say maybe 2-3 times a year, when I look out into the great, vast, unknown, spiraling eternities of space, on such times as this, upon me settles one of the subtlest of human moods. Now, there are some obvious human moods, joy, sorrow, gladness, aggressiveness, buggedness. These are obvious human moods, right? And most poets write about those moods. The human spirit, etc., etc., etc. Who was it in a work of literary? No good? All right, quit raising your hand so soon, honey. Wait, I mean, you must confirm these things. You would make a very, very bad submarine pilot. But nevertheless, most poets will write about this, the more obvious things in the human spirit, you know? Because these are the things that most of us feel. But way down in the bottom of that great, vast grab bag of conflicting emotions and shifting passions, that ball of yarn that makes up the human psyche, there lies one strangely lurking, rarely discussed fragment of perhaps the time when man sat in a Stygian cave and looked out upon a totally incomprehensible world. Now, what is this particular fragment, shard, if you prefer, of passion, of existence, of psyche? Well, it could conceivably be called I have to think this out carefully. It could be called the omnipotent awareness of lurking evil. Now, I'm not talking about the kind of evil that we're always writing editorials about, race, war. I'm talking about something else. And it is because of that kind of evil that we have for example, clairvoyance. Have you noticed? Oh, I'll tell you, the barbarians are on the march. Now, on full network color time, you can watch people predicting the future. And what's even sadder, other people taking them seriously. Oh, we're in strange times. Not really strange. Let's put it on this premise. It's not strange at all, because you see, all these various parts are in people, are suppressed at one time of history, and they grow at other times. Let's take sexuality. A lot of people think this is the time of great sexuality. This is greasy kid stuff compared to other eras of history. I'm serious. Greasy kid stuff. Well, what happened? Well, man said, well, we've had enough of that for a while. Let's concentrate on something else. And they did. And so then came the age of reason. And so everyone sat around and reasoned for a couple of hundred years. And the great salons of reason grew. And people like Stendhal. And out of that age of reason grew another crowd, the Freudians. That was later. And then, of course, since Freud was the prelude to another era of sexuality, we're in an ascending spiral. But how long that'll last, I don't know. But already there are signs that this has run its course. Many signs. I say the growth of the clairvoyant is a sign. For what it's worth. Now, you don't see the connection, but there is a connection. Very strongly. Because both areas of human existence are both inchoate, deeply ingrained, and are kind of wordless, non-literate passions. And so, sex, which is an instinct, there it goes. No, that's why there's never been anything really written about sex that makes any sense. Because it has no, it's a wordless thing. I mean, that's why music, critique, have you ever read music critique? It's jabberwocky. Well, they're attempting to describe a non-verbal passion in verbal terms, so they wind up by quacking away. Have you ever sat down and really seriously tried to read one of the jazz or pop critique magazines? And this is why most of them now have copped out, and they write mostly about race and very little about music. So ultimately, it's self-defeating. And I know, because I've written for music magazines. I used to write for Metronome. And the problem of writing about something is just like, in the same way, it's like writing a piece of music about a novel. It doesn't work. A piece of music is supposed to tell you about, let's say, Moby Dick. Doesn't make it. You have the sound of Over the Waves, and it just doesn't cut it. And so each one of these things, I think, represent another side of us. And since they do represent other sides of us, they come and go in cycles. There's always one side that's dominant. And there was a time, you know, during the age of the great, when the hordes poured out over Europe, the great barbarian hordes, it was an age of ascending violence. The violence was just, it was there, and it was very naked, very open, and out, and above board. And in many ways, you find that the violence that's beginning to slowly creep over the world is becoming very much like the violence of the age of the barbarians. And I remember one scene out of Alexander the Great, where one of the barbarian leaders, and after they had conquered the armies of the opposing side in battle and had left them the bodies of the enemies to rot under the sun, when he stalked into the headquarters of the chief of the civilized forces, you might say, the forces of a great civilization. He stalked in there and he said, "Ha! You call me a barbarian. Now you see who the barbarian is." And he motioned out to the plain where all the dead bodies were. And he never considered himself a barbarian. He considered himself a man with a mission. Carrying right. Everything going all right in there? Carrying right and truth to Greece, of all places. And I think that these various things come and go, and they rise and fall, but they're all part of the same structure. And oddly enough, extremely violent time when we had the last age of the great explorations. Much of the exploration, you know, that was done during the days of the Inquisition, when there was a lot of violence, and the whole world seemed to be in a turmoil, and so the urge to escape that world caused. And this is a psychological interpretation of the age of exploration. You know, for a long time, people gave economic reasons for the laws that governed the explorers during the great days of exploration. But now other people are beginning to say perhaps it was the inchoate desire to escape. Not just one man, but the society to escape. And they sent boats out to get away. It sounds familiar now. Now we've got people going to the moon, and we've got Russia going to Venus. You know, speaking of that, there was a little news note came through the other day. It was very intriguing. Do you know that the Russian pharmacologists, the scientists of Russia, you know, this is the workers' paradise. We all know about the paradise. And the pharmacologists have just created what they consider a tremendous boon for Russian workers. They've created a pill. Now, this pill is not a tranquilizer. This pill is designed specifically to deal with the blues. It's designed specifically to deal with the blues. Now, they're not talking about tranquilizers, nervousness, the blues. In other words, when you come home and you say, oh, you know, man, you know, and you sit there, well, this shouldn't happen in a paradise, should it, friends? And it was hailed by all Soviet scientists as a great advance because they say that increasing mechanization is causing great fits of blues among workers, and they can't get them out of it. That a whole factory will be down, really down. And so now what they're going to do is give them a pill every day, and they'll be up again. Well, that's an intriguing point. It's very interesting. And so if you're walking around out there and you're one of these people who believe that this is a workers' paradise over there, you better look at the little things that not many people talk about. The creation of a tablet to deal specifically with workers' blues says a great deal about workers' paradises. It really does. Which reminds me, speaking of workers, well, this is WOR. And we're a workers' paradise. Oh, yeah. And I'll tell you, this is such a sweatshop here, friends, that it's the first radio station that has salt tablets put beside every water cooler. Well, I should say beside every 7-Up dispenser. So, I'm sorry, man. I just had it. You know, that's a little jokey. Oh, let's see. We have the Datsun here now. And if you're the type of hard-hitting, dynamic individual who gets a kick out of driving, and you want to drive something that gives you a little fun driving in itself, we'd like to suggest that before you buy a car, if you're even remotely thinking of buying a car this year, you should look into the 1970 Datsun two-door sedan. It's a fine little automobile. And in fact, I predict that within the next 2 years or so, the Datsun will probably be one of the one or two or maybe three foreign cars on the road. It's already that way all over the world. It'll probably be that way in America very shortly. It's one of the safest automobiles ever built. The 1970 Datsun, and if you live in Jersey, you can see it at Oxford Motors on Route 46 in East Paterson. That's the 1970 Datsun. Zowie. Rosetta, Rosetta. We have our usual Rosetta spot here. And if you're a real electrical cuckoo, I like to walk around and pull on switches and press buttons and all that jazz and build things. If you're building a little electrical chair or maybe an electrified barbed wire fence to keep your neighbors out and all that stuff, you'll find Rosetta has got everything you want, man, at prices you can pay. Now, they have three stores, one at 75 West 45th Street, one at 79 Chambers Street, and the new Rosetta at 73 Murray Street, just two blocks west of City Hall, and they all have free parking. Just walk down the street and holler, Rosetta, and she'll answer, Rosetta. Okay? Now, let's get back to real life. Now, this was a long preamble. Very few poets ever talk about the dark side of the moon. I mean, the dark side of man's soul. I mean, the side where when you're sitting there, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and there's this 1932 picture on the TV set. There's Chester Morris is flying this OX-5 powered Jenny, and you could see the vague flickering image of Lola Lane down there on the flying field, and you know, you get this, what the hell is it all about? feeling. Oh, boy, I'll tell you. You know what I think a lot of people, I think this is really basically the thing that separates, I hate to use, because I don't want to talk about generation gap. I think it separates one group of people from another, of whatever age they are. One group of people constantly are bugged by that problem, that question. What the hell is it about? All of it. I mean, you find yourself in Nathan's, standing there knee-deep in the hot dog ends, and slapping on the mustard, and it'll cross your mind. You look around, you see this gallimaufry. You look around, you see it's Times Square, and you say, what is it all? What is this, you know? And then briefly, that it'll bug you, you see. You shouldn't think like this. And then you say, oh, hey, how about a cheeseburger, Mac? And then you're out of it. Well, now, the other group of people think that's a silly question. And they never ask it, see, because they know what it's about. It's about raising IBM's yearly take 4.5%. That's what it's about. Or it's making your bowling score make it this week, you know, rise above that 142 average. And that's what it's about. Other people think it's about sleeping. Others think it's about watching TV. And you know, I had a funny thing happen to me here a couple of weeks ago. This is a strange show tonight, isn't it? I had a funny thing the other night. Well, no, there are times when you just got to do it. And the other night, I'm out. It's the holidays a few weeks ago, and I take a trip out, and I'm sitting there in the kitchen. My mother's got this house and the whole thing, and she says this. I couldn't believe it. She says, you know, I wonder what people did before they had television. I said, Ma, you were there. You should be the one to tell me that. She said, well, yes, but I just wonder, I just think how Grandma would have liked television. I said, yeah, I sat there for a minute with the potato salad all over my face, and I says, well, how Grandma would have liked... Well, just think how George Washington would have liked it, Ma. You know, he'd have really probably dug radio. There's a pregnant silence in the kitchen there. I was speaking nonsense, of course, to my mother, you know, because it's quite obvious to anybody that we live better than anybody else in the past. You know, this myth always persists. It does. That with each new development, everybody says, gee whiz, this is it, man. This is fantastic. And you wonder how the hell anybody ever existed before it. Well, I sat there in the kitchen with her for a minute, and I said, Ma, I'm going to ask you a question. She said, what? I said, Ma, all right, I said, it's the year 2100, right? She said, yes, all right. I said, they're going to look back on us and say, how did those poor slobs exist without this ding-dong gimmick that they got in 2100. I says, look at us. We're sitting around here. We don't know it, see? And we don't miss it. You don't miss what you don't know. In fact, you're probably better off. And it was a long silence. In the next room, I could hear the color TV set going. You see, my mother keeps the color TV set going just to keep her company. It's quacking away in there, seeing that. And she says, well, I don't like it. That's silly talk. I said, yeah, that's silly talk. So if you think you got a generation gap, man, I got a... I mean, everybody's got it. I don't know. In fact, we got a people gap. You know, everybody thinks it's... Have you ever tried to talk to anybody just sitting next to you at Needix? I don't care what his age is. Just try it sometime. You ever try to talk to anybody in a subway? Try it, man. I don't care what age they are or what sex or color, man. Just try it. Just try it, that's all. Now, of course, there's always the illusion when everybody wears the same kind of button or they wear the same love emblem or something. They have the illusion that they're thinking alike. It's like Lodge Brothers. You understand that we're returning to the Lodge philosophy today. You know, a few years ago when my old man, I remember my father, he joined his lodge, see? And the first thing that he got was a golden pin with the diamonds in the eyes of this bird. This lodge was about some kind of bird, you know, like, have you ever watched Jackie Gleason and the Honeymooners? He belongs to the, what is the name of that outfit? The Raccoons? All right, now, everybody laughs at that. Well, you notice they wear a raccoon hat? Well, that's very important. You can't belong to a lodge unless you got badges that say you're in the lodge, or else there's no point in a lodge, right? So I wonder how many people walking around, you know, hip types, are in a not-yet-formulated lodge. They wear the stylized band the bomb thing, and they wear stylized love things and all that, and they're in a lodge just as much as my uncle was when he was in the Moose. Now, remember this, all these lodges come with great, overwhelming, fantastic codes. They all stand for great things. Like, if you've ever seen, do you know what, say, for example, the Moose really stand for? Have you ever seen the Moose code? Oh, it reads just like the hippie code. Yeah, we want to promote peace. We want to promote love. We want to promote good things. We want to promote fellowship, brotherhood. We want to promote, and you know, it's the same scene. It just takes different forms, different times. And the lodge syndrome, because you got to have a badge. If you don't have a badge, you're not in the lodge. I mean, who wants to join a lodge when it doesn't have buttons? By the way, I'm waiting. I'm a member of the Diners Club. This is a great club. And we have a hell of a time down at the club rooms once in a while. We get down there, you know, and there's a lot of drunks hanging around once in a while. But you know, but you have good times. That's why I joined it. Have you ever read the Diners Club news? You know, you get the news from various members around the country, you know, and, well, sure, we have chapters all over. And you know who our speaker was at our last yearly meeting? It was very exciting. It was held just off Thruway 12 in Cleveland. It was very exciting. And the speaker there at the National, this was, of course, the national meeting of all the executives and, you know, all of us who are active in the membership drives in the club. And our speaker, it was very exciting, our speaker at the club was Howard Johnson. He spoke, and we were very, it was very stimulating, and it was very exciting, really. And we're going, this coming year, we're going to have a wonderful tour, for those of you who haven't heard the club news lately. We're going to have a wonderful tour of all the Sunshine Motels in the northeastern states, and it's a guided tour. And we're looking forward to it. Of course, these things, you bring in your own little hang-ups, and what are you going to do? Actually, I'm like Truman Capote in that respect. I'm a genuine... I am sorry. I mean, there are certain points that we have in common. For example, you know that he is a motel cuckoo? I love motels. You know, everybody puts motels down. I dig them. I'm sorry. I dig motels. And I mean it. I mean, there's nothing greater than at 3 o'clock in the morning, find a motel that has a sign on it that says vacant. That's like hitting pay dirt. I mean, it's one of the most exciting moments. And especially after you've been traveling for 7,000 miles through the wastelands of Maine. And you keep seeing those signs. You know, they're getting so curt now. They don't say, no vacancy. They just say, no. That's all. Some of them just have an exclamation point. That's all. During the season, motels, they got you by, well, they got you by it, you know. And so you drive around, what's the matter? You drive around and one of those exciting, you know what I've done even sometimes? When I didn't even want to stop at a motel, when I saw a vacant sign, I just stopped because I knew, you know, you do not, it's like the travelers of old. You know how the travelers of old were. When you arrived at an oasis, even if you weren't thirsty, you drank. I mean, you never know when it's going to be a long period of not drinking. And also, you understand that primitive tribes, when the game is plentiful, they just stuff themselves like pigs. They eat like maniacs because they know there's liable to be months when there's not even a gopher is going to show up. And so they'll eat when it's there. Well, that's the way with the motel scene. You're driving along, it's 8 o'clock at night, and you're on your way to some place that's important. All of a sudden, you see a motel that says vacant. You just can't stop. You go in and you register. You know, you want to get in there, man. And so these, I'm a motel fan, I'll tell you about some great motels that I've been in. Are you curious about great motels? A lot of people, I've been in some unbelievable, I'm sorry, my whole show went to hell here, and I know I'm all of a sudden doing this, but I've been in some great motels. One motel that I was in one time, I'll tell you, it was like leaping backward and past, like leaping back into the early pioneer days. Don't ask me how it happened, but one time I found myself in a motel in Jacksonville, Florida. That motel, well, it was right out of the era when, there was a time when they used to call motels tourist cabins. Well, this motel had little white houses, but they were really downtrodden. I mean, really, the paint was all peeling off, and it had linoleum all over inside, and they had a big brass-type sink, came with the big handles and the knobs, and it was an old guy, he must have been 158 years old, who ran this scene. And I drove in there, and they didn't even have a place to put the cars or anything. You just drive in, you pull up, that's all. And you had a feeling that Humphrey Bogart must have stayed there, or Al Capone when they were on the lam. it was a great motel. And there are other motels which I think are so much stamped out. You've been in one Holiday Inn, you've been in them all. But that's not really a motel. To me, that's about as much. Well, they are motels, of course. But to me, that is about as much an exciting moment as, say, going into the A&P or the Bohack. Now, when you really have excitement is when you go into a little tiny two-bit delicatessen on 6th Avenue in New York at 4 o'clock in the morning. Now, that is a store. That you see scenes there, man. I saw a guy in one time on a Yoo-Hoo high you wouldn't believe. But these things you don't see in Bohacks in the middle of the afternoon. So I like to go into the motels. I would say, without a question, the most elaborate, spectacular, unbelievable motel that I ever was in, just unbelievable, was in a town in Mexico. It was in right across the border from El Paso. And I'm telling you, I stopped in this motel. It was named Camino Real. You ever hear of it? Right out of a Tennessee Williams scene, And it was. I just tell you. Well, it's the only motel I have ever been in that you had to dress for dinner. And I mean dress. I don't mean put on your sport coat. I mean dress. I couldn't get in. I couldn't believe it. I went down to the place. You're used to the motel where they have the coffee shop. You go in and this lady gets mad at you because you order hot coffee and stuff. The typical coffee shop motel. Well, I came downstairs, and they had a winding staircase. There's a lot of countries that are still heavily under the influence of 1938 Fred Astaire movies. Now, how do nightclubs look in Fred Astaire 1938 movies? You've seen those MGM nightclubs. You've never seen any nightclub like that in real life, there's always a guy sitting over in the corner with the black painted on hair. He's got the hair there. And everybody there is wearing a tuxedo. Everybody. And they drive up in front of this place. Carol Lombard gets out of the car, and it's called a Club Hotcha. And the thing, the lights are going off and on. And it's always run by this gangster. Well, you go into this place, and they have a long, winding staircase somehow, always, that goes down. And Carol Landis or Carol Lombard or one of the... with 84 actresses named Carol a few years ago. So they all go down this... Now we're in the age of the Julie. So, all the actors named Julie. So he goes, he and this chick go down the staircase, and you see this dance floor, and there's always a girl, usually somebody like Alexis Smith, and she's the nightclub singer. She's going around and she's singing such square stuff you wouldn't believe in your life. And it's all called jazz, and behind her there's this very distinguished looking orchestra of elderly men wearing tuxedos. And the seats, the people sit in circular tiers. It looks like horseshoe tiers, you see. And they're always ordering champagne. There's always interplay between the tables. And usually it winds up in a fight. Invariably, a fight breaks out when Humphrey Bogart walks in and he spots Edward Arnold, who's the big boss of the dock workers. and the big fight, the gun shoot, and the whole bit. Well, usually the decor in these nightclubs are black and white. At least you get that impression from watching black and white movies, you know, the walls. And they're ivory, and they're big staircases and lights. And usually a girl comes out and does a maracas dance. It's Carmen, what's her name? I forget the name. Carmen Marita, Chiquita Banana type stuff. Carmen Miranda, of course. Carmen Miranda. Who could forget Carmen Miranda? Carmen Miranda comes out with about 400 pounds of grapes and junk on her head. And she does this dance, and all these guys are sitting around. You notice all the people in the crowd nod? That girl has talent, they're all saying, you know, that kind of stuff. Oh, boy. And the camera keeps picking up George Brent, showing that he's very excited by this act. Well, now, I've never really been in a nightclub like that, you see. I've seen them in the movies all the time. And these movies always show these clubs, but I've never really seen one. My idea of a nightclub is the Red Rooster, which is in East Chicago, Indiana. And there's usually a guy playing a piano in there, and there's a couple of steel workers in the back being sick. And that's the nightclub, you see, and a trio there. And well, once in a great while, when they're really going out big, it's a New Year's or something like that, they get in this five-piece band, and on the drum they have a picture of Niagara Falls, and it lights up. Well, now, that to me is a nightclub. Now, I've been in other clubs. Now, I went in a nightclub once in Chicago one time, and it wasn't like these clubs that you see. They were to me, most clubs don't come up to the movie version of clubs. And now, that is in America. Now, in other countries, would you believe it that they actually believe in those clubs in America? And they make them like that. Now, that isn't their native club. I mean, they think they're being very American. So in the Camino Real, I go downstairs, and here is this winding staircase going up into what looks like a black firmament. They've got stars that light up and all that stuff. And here is a tremendous poster. You know the posters they always had in the opening when you'd walk in through the doorway in the Fred Astaire nightclub, Club Hotcha, or whatever it was called, Club Rendezvous. They always had names and script. You remember those things? There's this great big old DeSoto cab arrives in front, and George Brent gets out, and they're there to see Big Louie at the Club Rendezvous. Well, they usually had, in the front of these clubs, they had a big thing, and there was this blonde girl, and above it said, the blonde bombshell sings tonight, again, by tremendous demand. And you knew that she was the girlfriend of the gangster. This had to be, you see. Well, would you believe it, they had one there? Acts like I never saw in my life outside of a 1938 movie. Do you know that they had a tap dancer? I mean, a real nightclub-type tap dancer that danced up and down these white marble staircases with blue lights on them. And then out of the wings came this girl with this long black dress that hung down to the floor, sweeping dress, and they did a tango. The tap dancer and this girl did a tango, and I couldn't believe it. It was such a great nightclub act. It was right out of it. I kept looking around, see, thinking that I would see Edward Arnold, you know, the big boss. And would you believe it, I saw him? I'm not kidding you. There was a gang boss there. You could see he was some big cheese. There were a bunch of guys sat around, all around him with black sunglasses, and they had lumps under their arms. So I knew that they weren't carrying credit cards with the big lumps hanging down. I could spot, believe me, I can spot a .38 hanging under a tuxedo for a mile away. I've been trained, you know. You watch these old movies, you can train yourself. So I went into this nightclub. Now, you know how I got in the nightclub? I went downstairs, and here was this wild-looking nightclub. I don't think I've ever told you about this, have I? This wild, fantastic-looking nightclub. And I wanted to go, so I went to the desk there, and you should have seen the lobby of this place. The lobby of just the motel must have been 70 feet high. They had a chandelier that weighed 8 tons that hung down from the ceiling, and it was made out of old Mexican cannons or something. Just wild place. And I went up to the desk, and I said, excuse me. He says, senor. And I said, you know, we speak Spanish, all of us international types. And I says, I said, tuxedo mo. I want to go to night club. What's the word for nightclub? I want to go to Buenos Noches Club. And, si, senor. Uh-huh. And he took out a box of aspirins and gave them to me. I don't know what I was saying. See, so I says, no. Me, club. Sport Dakota. I want to go to club. Need a tuxedo. He says, and he says, Jose. And Jose comes out, and for a measly $34, I rent a tuxedo for 15 minutes. And they had a meter on it. Have you ever seen a tuxedo you rent that has a meter? It tells you how long you've been wearing it. See, the first 15 minutes are $40, and after that, well, I put on a tuxedo. I'll tell you exactly what happened. You can rent one. See, so I go in, and boy, you feel great. You know, I had this cardboard shirt front, and I had this tie made out of vinyl. They have a little vinyl. You just wash the ketchup stains off of it and so on. It's a universal tuxedo. So I put it on, I go in, and I walk up this long winding staircase. You feel very romantic. I wore my shades. I feel very romantic. Americano is coming tonight, the club. I've came up through the treasure of the Sierra Madre. You know, you can't, I've seen Humphrey Bogart when he is in Mexico. And, they sit around all the Mexican people and they say, Yankee, what's the other thing you say? Paisano. No, that's a other movie. That's Roberto Rossellini movie. But nevertheless, I went into the clubs and I sat down. Guy comes over and I ordered, I didn't know what to order. You know, I'm in a Mexican club. I says, tortilla. he looked and eyes flashed. I says, no. Specialty lache. And he says, oui. So. So he brought me the specialty of the house. It was kind of this lumpy thing. It cost $38.50. And, brought it, had little olives sticking out of the top of it. And he brought me some of this, Mexican wine. For those of you who have never had Mexican wine, steer clear. Mexican wine, you can write with it. But he brought me, this Mexican wine, and I sat there and drank wine. And I watched this great Mexican show. Do you want to hear what else was on the bill? You're curious what happens in a real Mexican? And all the very chic Mexican people from all around. You can see the rich types and Mercedes are out in front and everything, and they Bentleys and all that stuff. And I'm sitting there in the middle of this 1935 nightclub scene, and out came one of my favorite club acts that I've seen many times. Have you ever seen a mind reader? You see those in old movies once in a while. Tyrone Power plays a mind reader in one of his great movies. Have you ever seen it? It was on a few weeks ago, man. If that ever shows up on television again, watch it. Nightmare Alley. It's a gas. Yeah, it's a great book. And that was the day when they had mind readers would come out dressed in tuxedos and read the minds of the people. He has a black mask. Well, he starts reading. Of course, it was all in Spanish. I couldn't figure it. And people kept saying, ole, 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 ole. And he would bow. And he had this beautiful blonde girl that went among people. And you'd give her a little note like, how much is this going to cost me? I always thought that would be a great thing to hand to a mind reader. What's the gaff? But nevertheless... Oh, I'm sorry. I'm being very sacrilegious tonight. You know, a lot of people out there these days, strangely enough, or maybe predictably enough, when religion is slowly sinking in the West, up comes astrology. So, I mean, you know, the very people who will put down religion as being superstitious will have as astrological signs all over their shirt. And I really believe in this stuff. But, so I'm sitting in the middle of this nightclub. And whenever you get in a scene like that, you can't let yourself go completely. So I started to make eyes at this chick at the next table. You know, you're know, making eyes. You know, I'd hold the wine glass up and say, you know, I say things like Aviva. And she looks flashing dark olive eyes, you know, just this. By the way, there's nothing prettier than a Mexican girl. Oh, boy. The beautiful Mexican girls in this beautiful Mexican nightclub scene. And this girl just, it was driving me mad. So I kept going, ole. Things I have a few Mexican Spanish type words. I'd hold up, I'd say, bodega. You know, she kept looking at me. One thing I said, mucho dinero.
And she says, "Ah, oh, Cece, won't you dinero?" And we laugh. And all of a sudden, this guy, I never knew Mexicans came 7 feet tall. This 7 foot high Mexican came in. I mean, he made maybe 280, 285. And he sat down with this beautiful girl, and he just gave me one look. It was the universal look. I mean, you get that look in Greenland, you get that look in Scotland, you get that look in the, you go, Zamboboanga, that look means hands off, Fink. One more smart crack from you, and you're going to be out in the parking lot with a busted vertebrae. Right? I says, si, senor, gracias, buenas noches, amigo. And he says, oh, yeah, amigo. And a little thing with the thumbs, meaning my chick, hands off, or you will be made into a tortilla. This was one of the finest nightclub motels I've ever... Oh, I'll tell you, it cut every Holiday Inn I ever been in. It was just beautiful. I was out in the pool the next day. Oh, yeah, life, gratissimo, buenas noches, bodega. Oh,
three bright ideas for people who have...